On the other hand, Jack said, Dr. Radley appears to demand total control over everybody, where, how they live, what they're doing, saying, thinking, every minute, even what they eat and drink. I was told I had 6 minutes to drive from the estate's front and only gate to the car compound to have my car locked up. Your car? You have a car of your own? I bought one in Virginia. What is it? A Miata. A used Miata. Phew. Global cable news must have overpaid you, too. I'll have a word with Alex Blair about that. Affects my dividends, don't you know? I believe Shauna was right. Somebody is trying to knock off Chester Radley. Shauna is the girl who's going to marry young Chester? Jack hesitated. I'm not sure she's going to marry him. Oh, has the vision of you arriving in your two-seater chariot re-diverted her heart? I think she's misread at least one thing here. I think I'm putting 2.3 and 2.3 together. And coming up with 5, I hope? Right. Would you think of coming here to Vindemia? Ain't been invited. You have to admit these are too many coincidences. There are a lot. And you are more a peer of Chester Radley. Little old me, a peer of the man who invented the perfect mirror. You think I invented the raspberry, maybe? Come on, Dad, I'm just a kid. Come on, Dad, I'm just a kid. There was that cool breeze again. Fletch shivered. What do I know? Your mother comes first. Fletch felt noble in the saying. I'm trying to prevent a murder here, and I don't think there's a whole lot of time. I'm just not sure, Fletch said. We'll just have to see how things work out. Okay, Jack said. Wish Mama mal appetit. Fletch said, don't break any mirrors. Fletch? It was later in the evening. Crystal and Fletch, sleepy now, were still keeping each other company in the parking lot of the Bessemer Motel. They heard a dance band playing from somewhere in the motel. They weren't dancing. What's the difference between fat people and slim people? Fletch said, fat people have more weight. Answer me seriously. It doesn't really have anything to do with big bones. My bones aren't big. Or glands. Surgery could fix that. Genetic proclivities? No one in my family I ever heard of was fat. Not like me. Fletch said, I think it may have something to do with what one puts in one's mouth, do you suppose? I know that, but why do you put what you put in your mouth and I put what I put in my mouth? I'm not comfortable feeling full of food. I guess you are. I see that. You hate having all this food in greasy bags around the van, don't you? Every time you open food parcels you've gotten for me, you sort of wrinkle your nose. I do. You do. You wrinkle your nose and look away. Why does food that looks good to me repel you? Habits, I guess. Just what we're used to. It's more than that. I once heard a famous professor of nutrition at Northwestern say something about people having to set or reset something like a food thermostat in their heads. What does that mean? Fletch said, you become more acutely aware of what food you need to get along and only consume that much, no more. You eat high-energy food, the food that creates its own energy, causing you to use it up, burn it off with activity. You don't eat food that weighs more than the energy it produces. Something like that. The throbbing engine of an 18-wheeler at the back of the parking lot was keeping time with the dance band. I don't know. Why ask me? I've asked enough experts. Paying for advice doesn't guarantee much. Fletch, am I mentally ill? Crystal, you're one of the brightest, most logical people I've known. Then why am I the way I am? What's logical about the way I eat? What sense does it make? I don't know. I mean, what do slim people know that fat people don't? I think slim people do know something. Please tell me what. I think slim people define hunger differently. I think slim people know that much of what you think of as hunger they realize is a food hangover. Have you ever noticed that when you eat more than usual, you feel hunger pangs sooner? Oh, yes, all the time. I think when you eat more than usual, the body produces more than usual gastric juices or something, and when they get done working on the food that is in the stomach, they send a signal to the brain saying they're ready for more food to work on. I think maybe fat people see that as a hunger pang. Slim people feel the same thing, but know they're not hungry because they know they've eaten more than they need already. Hunger I feel is not real? No, it's false. You just believe it's real. I'm not really hungry? You can't be. Have you read this somewhere? No, just many times I've had to ignore hunger and discover that the first hunger pangs aren't real. They mean nothing. The Chinese food syndrome. One is apt to overeat Chinese food. Therefore, an hour later, one has hunger pangs. But one doesn't really need more food. So, how do you know when you're really hungry? You know, your energy level begins to drop. Then you should eat real food, not sugar, to maintain your energy. You should know about how much of what kind of food you need to produce the energy you need every day and eat that much. And forget about the feeling of hunger. Something like that. I don't know what I'm talking about. I've been thinking about this, driving along, thinking about you. Maybe there are psychological reasons you are the way you are, as there are with everybody. I know you're not crazy, but a lot of the problem may be in your head, a misperception of what you're feeling. It's what that professor said about thermostats. Food stats. Something like that. We think about food differently. Like people who drink more than usual and then get up in the morning and respond to the hangover by having more to drink. It doesn't make sense. One doesn't need more to drink just because the liver or whatever is ready to process more. Hunger pangs are a food hangover, Crystal said. Now I've heard all. You asked. I'm no better than you. I just think about food differently. Maybe because you've been really hungry. Maybe. I wonder if I've ever been really hungry in my life. Probably not. I just feel hungry all the time. It's not hunger. Maybe you should write a diet book, Fletch. You think I could sell it? Nothing sells better than diet books. Diet books and cookbooks. I don't know anything about it. That's never stopped other people from writing diet books. I've just been thinking about it. About you. For you, maybe. His pocket communicator buzzed. He picked it up off the pavement beside his chair. Hello? Fletch, Mr. Mortimer called here again. Fletch said to Crystal, it's Carrie calling from the farm. Your lover, Crystal said. Give her my best. No, come to think of it, she already has my best. Carrie said, he sounds real mean, Fletch. Mr. Mortimer is real mean, Fletch agreed. He's warning you off his place loud and clear. How close are you to his boxer training camp or whatever it is now? Pretty close, another 3 hours maybe. We should be there by 9 or so in the morning. Fletch, he doesn't want you. Sure he does. Everybody likes me. I've told you that. He hates you. He just forgets. He insists you ruined his life. How could I have done that? I just got him to put all his friends in jail, that's all. Why should he be upset about that? Then he had to run for his life, he tells me. From the boxing world to cow heaven, he says. From New York City to Wyoming, which he hates or doesn't understand, or both. He's lonely, angry, bitter. And mean, I know all that. Fletch, this is the 7th or 8th time he's called here warning you off. You should hear him talk. I have. I think you better take him seriously. I do. It's a crazy idea anyway, taking an overweight lady to a boxer's training camp. I've had crazier ideas, Fletch said, that have worked out. Fletch, he said he's borrowed 3 shotguns from neighbors, that if you drive onto his place, he and his 2 boys, Hadja and Ricky, he says they're as mean as bare wire snapping in a rainstorm. They're as tame as garden hoses. Well, blast your head off. Boxers don't know how to aim beyond arm's length. Please, Fletch, he's serious. I'll swanee down the back. If he calls again, Fletch hesitated. What? Tell him we'll be there about 9 in the morning. Leave a lamp burning in the window, darling. I'll be home either with my head on my shoulders or carried under an arm, but I'll be there. After he clicked off, Crystal said, how much does Carrie weigh? 123 pounds. You don't know how much I weigh, do you? No. That's good. Chapter 12. Who? Jack's head snapped off the pillow. In his dark bedroom, he had been asleep on his stomach. His right leg was over someone else's legs. Those legs were muscular and smooth. His right arm was over someone else's stomach. He withdrew his arm and propped up his shoulders by his elbows. He thought he had been dreaming. He had begun to move. He was primed. He slid his leg off the legs of the other person's. Holding himself up on one elbow, he gently felt the other person's breasts. A naked girl had gotten into his bed with him. He breathed hard. He listened to the low hum of the window air conditioner. It had been weeks since a girl had been in bed with him. After biking in the dark back from Vindemia Village, he had played his guitar softly half an hour, thinking about his conversation with his father, about the previous weeks, setting the tribe story up with the authorities, his 5 weeks in the maximum security prison in Kentucky, his time in the encampment in Alabama, his working day and night in Virginia, how confining Vindemia was. He had been thinking about sex, how long it had been since he had loved anyone had loved him, thinking about girls he had loved and who had loved him, thinking about the when and where and how of some of the times he had made love, wondering how in this life with people moving great distances continuously, boys and girls, men and women got together, gobbled each other up, sometimes their minds and spirits as well as their bodies, given to each other, taken from each other, really loved and sometimes learned from each other, and then been separated by circumstances, families, schools, schedules, jobs, mobility, distances. No reasons romantic or usually even emotional, perhaps because of practicalities, society's new lessons, through its courts and centeredness on self in mental health practice, Jack's generation had been taught above all else that long-range relationships did not, would not, work. One must not hope or even think of such. So there were many of whom he thought, many missed, each once a swelling in his heart, now a scar. He ran his hand down the girl's body. He said, "Shauna?" There was an explosion next to him in the bed. The sheet was flung, kicked up into the air. A fist pounded down hard on the muscle below his right shoulder blade. A hand gripped the muscle of his right shoulder. Another gripped his right hip bone. He was flipped over onto his back. She sat on the base of his stomach. She was slapping his head, face, shoulders with both hands. In the dark, he tried to find her flaying arms, grab them, protect his head. Finally, he crunched his stomach muscles, sat up enough to get his arms around her back. He pulled her down to him. She straightened her legs along his. He rolled over on top of her. She stretched her legs wide, hustled him inside her, gripped her legs behind his back. It continued violent and was sudden. Letting out a long exhale, she said, "Alexis." Then, almost immediately, she said, "More." There was more. He did not realize the skin of his back was torn until the shower's hot water hit it some time later. There was blood mixed with the water on the shower's floor. After drying off, he twisted to see the length of the gash on his back in the bathroom mirror. Then he was sitting on the edge of his bed. Behind him, on the bed, Alexis said, "Anything the matter with you?" "You cut me." "Oh, poor Jack." Instantly, in the dark, the tips of her fingers ran along the cut on his back. She had known she had cut him, exactly where. The cut was sticky and made her fingertips sticky. He was still bleeding a little. "For you," she said. "Red blood. Red-blooded boy." "Just thinking," he said. "What is poor bleeding boy thinking? Can't afford the blood? Do you mind losing it that much?" "If I did to you what you just did to me, I'd be in prison for 20 years. "Shit," Alexis said. "I'm not the first girl who snuck into your bed while you were asleep and fucked your brains out." "No," Jack said, "you're not." "Boys like it any time, any place, isn't that right?" Jack didn't say anything. "You all come with ever-ready batteries. I know that. I mean, you have it. You've got to give it. It's got to go someplace, isn't that true?" He said, "Yeah." "And you can't get pregnant." "What are you talking about?" "Girls have something long considered an asset, something they can sell, give away or not. It's their choice."
"And boys don't have a choice?"
"Not if a girl wants it. Boys are sexy. They produce and produce and produce, onto the ground or into a girl. It's a girl's choice to take it or not."
"I see.
Boys can't get hurt."
She knelt on the bed behind him. She folded her arms around his chest. She put her cheek on the top of his head.
"Did poor Jack get hurt?"
"You can't hurt a boy," Jack said, "is what you said."
"I'm sorry I scraped your back."
Moving against him, she was smearing the blood dripping down his back onto her belly.
"It's all right." "Does it hurt?"
"Stings."
"You shouldn't even complain about it."
"I'm not complaining."
"You can't say you didn't enjoy it."
"I enjoyed it."
"Boys always enjoy it."
"Sure," he said.
"Sure," she said. "Boys can't stop themselves." "Good boys always enjoy it.
Good boys are fucking machines. They're just there to be fucked. And what's also nice is that they never complain.
No, Jack said, never.
She clutched his hair with her fingers and pulled his head back, way back. Her other hand clutched his extended throat, his neck muscles, and squeezed. Her lips found his mouth. She forced her tongue through his lips, his teeth, into his throat. He had to twist toward her. Again, he wrapped his arms, around her back. Alexis said, more. There was more. Chapter 13. You have a cut on your back.
Yes.
While Jack was raking the Japanese garden, Radley's secretary, Nancy Dunbar, had come into the garden with a cup of coffee. She sat on the bench she and Jack had used the day before and lit a cigarette.
Don't let it get sunburned, she said, or you'll have a scar there forever.
I know. It was early Saturday morning. Jack was in the shade of the garden's wall.
Do you have anything to tell me?
Nancy Dunbar asked. His first time doing such a thing, Jack was trying to make an interesting design on the garden's sand with his rake.
Did he have anything to tell her?
In Nancy Dunbar's words, any plans you hear anybody make, if you see people together you think don't belong together, comments you hear people make about each other, Mr. Beauville, me, Dr. Radley. Only a few hours before, in the dark of his bedroom, he had found himself sucking his own blood from the tits of Dr. Radley's youngest daughter. Jack had heard that same daughter say she didn't care if her father was murdered, had heard Duncan Radley admit he had cheated to graduate from college, lied about applying to any business school, considered disobeying and selling stock in Radley Mirror to support his car racing interest and, Jack surmised, his drug habit. He had seen the elder son, Chet, All-American quarterback, betrothed to Shauna Stoffel, demand sexual attention from the stable boy. He knew there was a duffel bag full of beer under Pepe's bed. He had seen Dr. Radley himself and Shauna Stoffel sitting on a bench in a rose garden at dusk, talking quietly while holding hands. He had heard local people mock Nancy Dunbar.
Nope, Jack said. Nothing.
You've heard, seen nothing which might be of interest to us? Nancy Dunbar asked.
Nothing.
You're making the design in the sand too tight, Nancy said. Loosen up.
Loosen up?
Yes. Relax with the rake. Use it as a paintbrush.
I've never used a paintbrush, Jack said, except to paint a garage.
Think of an abstract painting, Nancy said. Make big swirls, curves, straight lines at odd angles.
Oh, you're too tight.
He started over. He didn't know what to do with the sand around the big jagged rocks in the garden. He sensed the lines made by the rake's tines ought not dead end at the rocks, but flow around them somehow.
It's Saturday morning, Jack said. Not even 8 o'clock.
Yes.
Nancy lit another cigarette.
You work every day of the week?
I'm supposed to have Saturday afternoons and Sundays off.
Do you?
Maybe once a month. This isn't a job, it's a living. Dr. Radley's mind never stops, and when he wants something, he wants it right away. He himself keeps a very tight schedule, but he never really knows or cares what time of day it is, or even what day it is. It's a little hard to understand that at first. It seems contradictory, doesn't it?
Is that all right with you?
That's fine with me. I'm going to be able to leave here someday reasonably young and very rich.
That's nice.
By the way, there's a big party here tonight.
You mentioned it.
You're serving drinks, whatever.
Drinks here at Vindemia?
Of course. Chester can't dictate the habits of the whole world. Show up at the kitchens of the main house about 5:30. White shorts, dress white shirt. They'll give you a blue bow tie when you get there.
Okay.
Tell me about anything odd you hear or see tonight.
Okay.
In the meantime, you can take this afternoon off.
Thanks.
I mean, don't plan to leave Vindemia in case somebody wants you, like go for a swim or something.
Eric Beauville, dressed in plaid shorts and a pink short-sleeved shirt, stood in the arched gateway of the Japanese garden. He had a manila folder in one hand.
No, you better not go for a swim, Nancy said. You don't want that cut on your back to scar.
Beauville said, a gardening accident?
Jack said, I got scraped.
Sure, Beauville said. Did the same tree give you those hickeys on your neck and chest?
Nancy Dunbar looked at Jack with narrowed eyes. Laughing, Beauville sat on the bench next to Nancy.
I'm blessed by farsightedness.
Who? Nancy started to ask.
Beauville nudged her.
Give me a cigarette.
She did so and lit it for him. "It's nice that ladies can carry purses," Beauville said, inhaling gratefully. "If old Chester ever spotted a package of cigarettes on me, he'd tongue-whip me for weeks and see that my health insurance premiums tripled." He took another deep drag. "Yet I don't seem to be able to get off this goddamn place without an excuse from a doctor, which I can't get because Chester's got a kept doctor on the estate." Nancy said, "I thought you were to play in a golf tournament in Sea Island this morning." "Were is right," Beauville exhaled. "I were. Our inspired leader called me at 5:15 a.m. demanding a complete review of his will, estate, trusts, cash in hand." "You mean will?" Nancy asked, "as in last will and testament?" "Last will and testicles," Beauville said. "Nicholson is flying in from Atlanta. Clarence is on his way here from Rockton." Jack asked him, "Am I supposed to disappear at this point?" "Nah," Beauville said. "Without even checking, I know you're not mentioned in the will. What's your name?" Jack said, "That's a relief." "I like the design you're making," Beauville said. "Nice and tight." "Thanks. And you don't look a bit Japanese." "Sorry." "Too tight," Nancy said. "That's what I can do to annoy Chester," Beauville said. "I can put the proposition to him seriously. If he has a Japanese garden, why doesn't he have a Japanese gardener? I'll hint he might be charged with discrimination." Nancy said, "He'd take it seriously." "I know he would. Someday I'd like to drive him as nuts as he drives me." "You're not smart enough, Eric," Nancy said. Beauville said, "I can try." "What could he be thinking?" Nancy asked. "Why the rush review of his estate?" Beauville extinguished his cigarette against the sole of his loafer. "Maybe Jim Wilson's being killed by lethal gas in a laboratory where there wasn't known to be any lethal gas yesterday has something to do with it." He handed his cigarette butt to Nancy. "Jim must have been planning some experiments of his own." She put Beauville's cigarette butt into the Ziploc baggie in her purse. "Or someone else at the lab was." "Sure," Beauville said. "There's an explanation for everything." Dunbar said, "Things happen." Beauville said to Nancy, "Chester didn't want me to play in that golf tournament this morning. He never wants me to leave Vindemia. He's afraid someone reasonable might make me an offer to run a reasonable company and live a reasonable way of life." "You never would," Nancy said. Beauville said, "In a heartbeat." He stood up. "Come on, you have to help me get some papers out of one of the smaller underground bomb-proof safes." She collected her purse and her empty coffee cup. Looking at Jack's rake design in the sand, Beauville said, "It's getting too loose now. I liked it better before." Scurrying after Beauville, Nancy Dunbar said, "It's still too tight." Chapter 14. "Here we are," Fletch said. "I think." There was no sign on the long, empty dirt road. There were just decayed fences extending out of sight both sides of the road. "Oh, joy," Crystal said from her bed in the back of the handicap van. "I finally get to meet Mr. Mortimer, the meanest man in the world. Do you suppose he will hang me upside down by my toes?" "He might." A half mile down the road on the left, a few buildings were visible in the shade of a clump of deciduous trees. Fletch felt for Mortimer. This sparse country was a long way indeed from the noisy arenas of the Northeast. He almost felt guilty. "He just might." They were arriving at Mortimer's boxing camp even earlier than Fletch had thought. It was 8:05. Neither Crystal nor he had slept well. They had gotten on the road before dawn. They stopped only twice for food, and not at all for lavatory facilities. The first person Fletch asked in the small Wyoming town gave immediate simple directions to the boxing camp. The local citizen Fletch asked said, "You mean that mean son-of-a-bitch New York bastard?" He knew just where Mortimer lived. Fletch said, "He may hang us both up by the toes." Fletch accelerated the van down the bumpy, dusty road. "Fletch," Crystal complained from the rear of the van, "you might bounce me off the bed." "I've decided to try to take the old bastard by surprise." Seeing the place, Fletch considered that Mortimer had real reason to shoot Fletch on sight. "Fletch, slow down. Hang on. Are you sure you're doing the right thing bringing me here?" "Of course not." "Help, let me out." "Now, Crystal," Fletch said in a reasonable tone, "you wouldn't know you were in Wyoming without a rough ride." A lanky old man appeared at the edge of the cluster of trees surrounding the buildings. In one hand was a shotgun. He fired into the air. A shirtless boy in shorts ran to a position a few meters from Mortimer and knelt on one knee. He, too, carried a shotgun. He took aim at the van. He fired. A puff of dust arose in the air just in front of the van.
"Fletch!" Crystal screamed. "They're shooting!"
"They're shooting," Fletch said, "but they ain't hitting." He began swinging the van's steering wheel. "Zigzag," he said.
"Fletch! Enough of zigzag! I'm sloshing around back here!"
Through the rearview mirror, Fletch saw the bottom half of Crystal's sheet rising into the air. She must be raising her legs, he realized. He didn't know she could do that. Mortimer, having reloaded, fired at the van. His shot went high. Fletch left the road. He aimed the van straight at Mortimer. He accelerated. Going over ground even rougher than the road made the van jounce wildly.
"Fletch!" Crystal sounded like she was strangling. "You're beating me to death!"
Mortimer jumped out of the way. Holding a shotgun by the barrel like a club, the boy ran after the van. Fletch stopped the van near the buildings in the shade of the trees. In the swirling dust, the boy stopped a meter from Fletch's open window. "Hi," Fletch said through the window. "Are you Hadja or Ricky?"
"Ricky."
"What? Say that again."
"Ricky."
"Wow."
"Ricky." "What is the matter?"
"Never heard anybody say that before, I guess, that way." The 16-year-old had the perfect boxer's build, but his voice had a timbre that sounded as if it were coming from the back of a miles-long cave. Ricky, holding the shotgun by the barrel with one hand, gently rested its butt on the ground. He positioned his legs oddly, creating the impression of being totally alert and relaxed at the same time. Chin tilted sideways, the boy's eyes looked at the ground between them. Then he ran his eyes slowly up the van's door and fixed them on Fletch's face. Doing these simple things, the boy gave the impression of complete readiness to listen or to fight, to laugh or to twist Fletch's head off.
"Wow," Fletch said. "Fascinating."
Fletch was dimly aware of Mortimer stumbling up, yelling his head off. He tuned Mortimer in.
"G-D-S-O-B, I told you to stay a state's length away from me. I told you if you showed up here, I'd shoot you. And God damn it, I will."
So great was Mortimer's fury that he dropped the shell he was trying to jam into the shotgun. Another young man, heavily muscled and well over 6 feet tall and naturally darker than Ricky, stood under a nearby tree, his long arms relaxed at his sides. Fletch said to him, "How you doing, Hadja?"
"Good," Hadja answered.
Fletch surmised from both boys' sweaty hair and dusty socks they had been on a long run. He envied them. While Mortimer was picking the shotgun shell off the ground, Fletch got out of the van.
"Dreadful-looking place you got here," Fletch said. "It's a wonder we didn't give it back to the American natives."
As Fletch walked straight up to him, Mortimer dropped the shell again. He snapped the empty gun barrel closed. He pointed it at Fletch's stomach.
"I told that damned woman of yours who answers your phone in Tennessee that if you showed up here, I'd blast your head off."
"Fletch?"
Crystal's voice quivered from the back of the handicap van.
"Fletch?"
"She's not a damned woman," Fletch said, "and she's not mine. She does answer the phone when it rings. And I don't much appreciate a city foulmouth like you shouting barnyard language at a genuine country lady long distance." Mortimer's eyes were blazing.
"I'll be damned."
He flung the empty shotgun onto the ground.
"I'll show these boys how I can take you apart with my fists."
Fletch backed up. "Never mind, I suspect they know you can." Mortimer's fists were raised.